the Department of History at Ohio State University and its new Jewish Studies program sponsored a two-day conference on American Judaism the last 30 years. I was invited to give the presentation on Reform Judaism. And the question that I addressed there was this. We are accustomed to thinking of liberal Judaism as on the cutting edge of the changes which take place in the society, the changing needs of Jews. Certainly much of the record of the last two centuries would indicate that we've been successful in that regard. And the question is really, do we continue to meet those needs now? Or have there been certain changes in the cultural envelope and the political situation which we find ourselves, which suggests that for the first time in this long history, or for one of the times in this long history, liberal Judaism may be out of sync, may not be, in fact, meeting the spiritual, religious needs of major segments of the American Jewish community. Now, as I prepared that paper, which incidentally will be printed in the next issue of the Temple Bulletin, you'll have a chance to read it there, I became increasingly convinced that though I would stay within the time frame, the 30 years that were allotted to me, that to truly gain perspective on the challenges and the problems which face non-Orthodox Judaism in the last half of the 20th century, we have to take a longer look at liberal Judaism, to go back to the beginnings. For in so many ways, the beginnings of any movement, philosophic or religious, or ideological, determine what it will be successful at and what it may not be as successful in doing. And when we look back at the origins of Reform Judaism in the early part of the 19th century, we remind ourselves that it was a response to a transformation, a rather radical and dramatic transformation, which was taking place in the political situation of the Jews initially, and then significantly in the cultural conditioning in which Jews participated, and that its major successes lay in validating change, in authorizing adaptation, the reshaping of Jewish life to fit the needs of a new Jew who emerged in Central and Western Europe during the 19th century, who thought differently and had different aesthetic tastes and different philosophic ideas than had his predecessors several generations before. Now, if Reform began in order to validate change and adaptation, it may not be as successful when the issue is no longer to accept change, but somehow to resist change, or rather to resist that dramatic impact of eternal change, which has become a large part of the social and cultural conditioning world to which we must react. The question is, can Reform provide a sense of the changeless? We no longer need to be convinced that Judaism needed to be reshaped. The question is really, is there a Judaism? There have been all these adaptations, but what are the essentials? What are the central core ingredients of this tradition? What is it that a non-Orthodox Judaism can offer the individual, you and I, can offer us at this point in our history? Now, when Reform Judaism came into being, it faced a Jewish life which was just beginning to break out of medievalism. One of the things that historians try to make clear, and which we don't always remember, is that Europe had about 400 years between the Dark Ages and the French Revolution, ages in which it went through the Renaissance and the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation, and then in the 18th century, the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment of the Philosophe, a long period of time in which it slowly nurtured and nourished and adjusted to a new set of values. For Jews, the step from medievalism into the modern world may have been a matter of a few days or a few years. We had no long period in which we could incubate and develop these new ideas. For until the French Revolution in 1789, Jewish life, with very rare exceptions, remained steeped in a classic medieval world, a world in which Jewish life, Jewish thought was encapsulated, in which it maintained the traditional curriculum. Jews had their own language. We had our own culture. We were in Europe, but not of Europe. And if you had brought together, let's say, a graduate of the Breslau Yeshiva or the Hamburg Yeshiva, and a graduate of Christ Church College at Oxford, you would find that about the only thing that they had in common was their native intelligence. And then suddenly, new ideas were abroad, or rather, new ideas began to have an impact on our Jewish community. France proclaimed the end of the Ancien Régime, a revolutionary republic, the rights of men. And after some hesitation which lasted about 3.5 years, they decided that even Jews could be considered as men, as citizens, and granted to the Jews of France all the rights of all other citizens. And then about a dozen years later, when Napoleon succeeded the revolution, became first consul of France, and he led the French armies across Europe. Wherever they went, they broke down the ghetto walls. They brought the ideas of liberty, equality, and fraternity, as long as one accepted these under the authority of the French emperor. And Jews suddenly emerged from the cramped quarters, from the cultural world, which was an enclosed one, in which they had survived. And those Jews who did come out found themselves in a new world and not necessarily able to speak its language and certainly not able fully to understand its cultural terms. Now, much of the history of the 19th century can be read as an attempt by the traditional powers of privilege in Europe to recreate that society of privilege which they had once enjoyed. And among other things, this meant was to deny the Jews again the emancipation, the opportunities which were offered to them by these new ideas. But Humpty Dumpty had fallen off of the wall, and Humpty Dumpty had had a great fall, and all of the king's horses and all the church's men couldn't put the old world, the Ancien Régime, back into place again. And so in each decade of the 19th century, a larger number of Jews became of Europe. They went to European schools, were tutored by European people who knew European culture. They spoke French or German or English, as well as perhaps as Yiddish. They participated in all of the cultural opportunities which their urban societies permitted them. And now there had to be a new presentation of Judaism which would be shaped to the way in which they thought, to the terms which had become second nature to them, which spoke to a new cultural condition. Thus, the emergence of a non-Orthodox tradition. Now, this non-Orthodox tradition, as it developed in the early part of the 19th century, was really more a matter of certain changes of style than changes of substance. The early reforms were not major reforms. The reformers wanted a service in which there would be decorum and dignity rather than the hubbub, the moving about, the endless noise, undertow of noise that one heard in a traditional synagogue. They thought that it would be nice to have a service which would be accompanied by a choir and perhaps even by an organ, more elaborate music, more developed music than the rather simple sing-song, the chants which were familiar in the traditional synagogue. And finally, they were determined to sit together as families, to take down the mechitza, the wall of separation between the genders, to bring the women down from the balcony. This was a world in which the family unit, for the first time, became important. Now, one can validate all of those changes and the change which was equally important to them, that is, that the service would be understandable, not simply in Hebrew and in Aramaic, but in the vernacular, whatever the language of their country might be. One can validate all of these from the tradition. The Talmud says specifically that one can pray to God in any language, that the tefillah, the Amidah, can be spoken in any tongue. The rabbis of Italy, the Orthodox rabbis of Italy 2 centuries before, had encouraged the use of composed music of the choir, and they had, in fact, in certain situations, permitted the building and the use of an organ in their synagogues. There is nothing in the Torah or the early sections of rabbinic codes which demand that the women be seated separately. And then later on, we would discover that, in fact, in the earliest synagogues of the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd centuries of this era, there were no separations as such, no mechitzot between men and women. And one could quote Maimonides at length in a famous letter which he wrote to the elders of Cairo, complaining bitterly about the noisiness of Jews at worship in the synagogue that was next door to his home. He called it a disgrace. Jews should worship with the same dignity, in his case, as Muslims did, quiet reverence of God. Now, none of this was very dramatic, but any change tends to scandalize the traditionalist. And it's not only that there's a certain cake of custom, there's a certain assumption built into all of us that what was is what ought to be, that what is familiar is somehow right. But there's something in the very nature of religion which suggests to us that we ought not to move away from the familiar. Religion is, after all, fundamentally an attempt within any cultural group to affirm and to confirm certain values, to declare these to be ancient and valuable and sacred. And the minute you begin to encourage change, you raise doubts in people's minds that what you declare to be fundamental, that is, the basic moral and spiritual concepts of the tradition, are also subject to change. And since there's no way in logic to prove that one set of ethical values rather than another, one spiritual approach rather than another, is the right one, since you cannot establish that kind of truth by any kind of logic, one needs to have the sense built into one's synagogue or one's church or one's mosque, one's home world, that the old-time religion is, in fact, a confirming faith in which one can trust. Nevertheless, there needed to be change, and these early challenges to reform forced those who were the leaders of the early reform movement to think through the question as to what was their authority to make these changes. And what they did was to appeal from text to history. If you'd asked a traditional Jew in the 19th century how he knew that one ought to keep a kosher home, how he knew that one ought to separate men and women in services, he would say, "Shtei geschrieben." It's all written down. It's all Torah. What he really would have meant is if I pick up the 16th century great code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, I would find all of these rules set down, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's no question about it, and set down as if they were part, they had been authorized through God to Moses on Mount Sinai. But Reform turned to a different discipline. It turned to the discipline of history. It turned to the issue of time. And when we look at our Jewish tradition, we find that it has an interesting history of history. We were among the first historians in the ancient world. The Bible is, of course, an attempt to write sacred history. And within the biblical tradition, there are two large blocks of literature which are rather developed, consistent histories given their purpose and their time. One is a section which runs from Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, which is called the Deuteronomic history, which tells the history of our people from the beginnings down to the Babylonian exile. And the other, the Book of Chronicles, Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, which tell the history of our people from the beginnings down to the Persian period. And then also in the period which immediately follows, the period of which we call the Hellenistic Age, we find that Jews were fascinated by history. The Maccabees had the history of the Hasmonean dynasty written out. There were a number of important individual historians, Nicholas of Damascus, Artaphanus, and of course, the best known, Josephus. And then an interesting thing happened, and that after this beginning fast period of about 1,200 years in which Judaism wrote its literature really around the terms of terms which are historical, we abandoned history. And from the time of Josephus, the end of the first century, to the 19th century, you will not find a single history written by a Jew about our own people. You will find an occasional collection of lists of sages and rabbis listed by their generation, and this was important for various legal purposes. In the Middle Ages, you will find an occasional listing of all the terrible tragedies and persecutions, the martyrdoms which had occurred to our people during the Crusades and after. But no one set out to write a history of the Jewish people as we had passed through time. Now, there have been many who have wondered about this sudden closing of the doors, closing of interest, closing off of interest. And the reasons seem to be many, but the most important one seems to be that history is of interest only to those who make history. If you look at the earliest histories, you'll find that they were almost always written by courtiers who were writing for some king who had made certain important conquests or built certain major monuments, and they knew that he would flatter the king by showing him the important things that he had established and he had achieved during his reign. And the people who are most fascinated by history are precisely those who feel the impact of their power or of their culture upon their times. Josephus was among the Roman legions who besieged Jerusalem in the year 70, and he watched the breaking down of the walls of Jerusalem and the burning of the temple. Josephus represents a man who lived at that moment in time when Jews suddenly fell off the stage of history. We went into exile. We were now a minority people whose political situation was entirely determined by others and who understood their own situation as if we were prisoners under a life sentence. And as prisoners who were under a life sentence, the days mean very little. You have no sense of being able to control your situation. You live either in remembrance of what it was when you were still free, biblical times, or in the foretaste of what it'll mean when you are pardoned, the Messianic Age. But in Europe, in the 17th and 18th century, Europeans, for a variety of reasons, had become fascinated again with history. And this interest passed over to the Jewish community. And in the early part of the 19th century, Jews began to look at Judaism not in terms of something which had been consistent, stylized, one thing over time, but they began to see that Judaism was a process, that Judaism had evolved and changed, and that which was meant Judaism to the Jew, the traditional Jew of the 19th century, was in fact a composite of any number of changes, of reforms, if you will, which had taken place over the long centuries. And so reform turned to history in order to validate change. Moses had never seen a Sefer Torah, Akiba had never been bar mitzvahed, and on and on and on. Now, history was used by our early liberal Jews as a way of breaking down the assumption that religious people tend to have, Jews certainly had, that it had all been given to Moses at Mount Sinai, it was constant, unchanging, and therefore that Judaism could clearly and easily be defined. But Reform then faced another question. And the question was this: if in fact Judaism is a process, an evolutionary process, a change, the traditions have changed over time, what is constant? What is it that we can call Judaism? What is it that Judaism has to teach? And to try to answer that question, because they were children of a philosophic or ideological age, they turned to the world of ideas. And they looked for the silken threads, which they said run through Jewish history. Single ideas or composite of ideas around which Judaism has constantly shaped and reshaped itself. If the institutions have changed and the practices have changed, they claim that the basic themes had not changed. God wills us to live a certain way. There are moral duties, the importance of the family, the importance of learning, the oneness of God, the sense of humanity, the immortality of the soul, perhaps for some divine providence, reward and punishment. And you will find the 19th and a large part of the 20th century filled with books by men and women who are interested in the liberal tradition, claiming to set out what we might call essential Judaism, to set out the essential ideas around which Judaism forms itself. Now, as early as the middle of the 19th century, the greatest historian of the time, Jewish historian of the time, Hermann Gratz, looking at a number of these volumes and writing an essay about them, commented that they reveal as much about what the individual Jew believes to be Judaism than they reveal about what Judaism in fact is, because each one is an impressionistic study. Each one tended to find in Judaism what he, in a sense, already believed Judaism to be. But leaving that problem aside, the great issue that this approach to the understanding of what Judaism really is that it is reductionist. It reduces a living tradition, a set of rules, of duties, of practices, of ceremonies, of institutions, to a set of ideas. The greatest quotation that the pulpit in the 19th century, the liberal pulpit, loved to bring out was, "It hath been told thee, O man, what is good, and what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." And the important word there was only. God is one, God requires the moral life. And this was the period in which it was popular for textbooks, confirmation texts, and otherwise to define Judaism as ethical monotheism. Now, there's nothing wrong with that definition. Judaism is a monotheistic tradition, and Judaism emphasizes one's social and private moral duties. But at the same time, Judaism is more than simply an idea called ethical monotheism. Judaism is the Seder, Judaism is the high holidays, Judaism is a set of dietary and other customs. Judaism is a pattern of one's religious life. And all that is somehow missing. It's interesting when you read the sermons of the 19th and early 20th century that you'll often find them quoting a little agada which is told in the Midrash, that one day a Roman came to the sage Hillel and said to him, "I want you to explain Judaism to me while I'm standing on one foot." And Hillel said, "All right, I'll do that. Stand on one foot." And the man began standing, and he said, "Judaism is, the Torah is essentially, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. That is the whole Torah." And that's where that quotation, that illustration stops in most of these sermons. But Hillel didn't stop there. Hillel added some very short but very important words. The rest is commentary. Lech v'azil, go and study. And the commentary is what gives body, what gives substance, what gives power, what gives immediacy to our entire religious experience. And so we had through most of the first half of this century, certainly in American liberal Judaism, we had this kind of thinking. Why do I have to keep the Sabbath? Why do I have to come to services? Why do I have to have a religious moment called the Seder in order to be good? You tell me that being good is the important thing, what God requires of me. Why do I need any of these religious moments in order to be good? Can't someone be good without being pious? And the answer, of course, is you can be. If your only a standard of judgment of what Judaism is all about is that it's an ethicism, it teaches one or another set of moral standards, you obviously don't need the religious life in order to develop character. And so there was a stripping away for a long period of time of all that was distinctive, of all that gave Judaism shape. And then about 50 years ago, just about the time that the sense of the tragic began to intrude on Jewish life, when Jews began to give up the hope that there was out there some brotherhood of goodwill, an emerging sense of humanity, which would allow all of us to share something in something which would be called the Judeo-Christian tradition or some world religion. At just about that time, and because Jewish life was beginning to go through that series of traumatic shocks from which we've not yet recovered, which began really with the pogroms of the 1880s and was increased then by the shock of the Stalin purges in the 1930s and then the rise of Nazism and of fascism and the Holocaust itself and the Arab Wars. Just about that time, Jews almost instinctively began to ask of their non-Orthodox synagogues that they reflect a little more of the color of the tradition, that they become places of warmth which spoke to the heart as well as to the mind. The intellectualization of Judaism was no longer sufficient. Judaism was not an idea. It had to be a way of life, as in fact our fathers had always assumed it to be. And so we began to see the increased use of Hebrew in the worship. We began to have customs like the bar mitzvah and the bat mitzvah introduced or reintroduced. We began to have a sense that at least in the synagogue, the Jew would find signs and signals which would allow him to sense the distinctiveness of that which is Jewish. But over the last years, though we have sensed this change in us, we have not developed an understanding of how to accept these changes, how to make sense of them, what to accept, how to see that they are not simply matters which we can, as folkways, accept or not accept, but they have many of them within them what we would call mitzvah, the divine command itself, demanding a response of us. Because we've really never examined, as non-Orthodox Jews, what is the source of authority? What is it that says you must? What is it that requires of us an active response? History said to us, Sinai was not what the Torah describes it to be. It is possible to even deny that Sinai ever took place. What then is it that commands obedience of Jews, and to what ought Jews to respond obediently? That is, non-Orthodox Jews, Jews who can no longer accept as true the myth of the revelation of the entirety of our tradition at Sinai. And that's the problem which we have not thoroughly examined. And that's the problem for which there is as yet no conventional way of thinking which has gained wide acceptance among our people. We know that we want to respond. We remind me of the smoker who knows that they ought to quit, but hasn't yet decided that they must quit. We live in a world which is full of confusion and noise, violence. We want a sense of the sacred. We want some guidance. We see all about us the disintegration of many of the moral values which we know to be right, instinctively know to be so. We're concerned about the integrity of families. We're concerned about our own dignity, our own sense of values. We are being besieged, badgered all the time by all kinds of voices which tell us to be careless or indifferent or hedonistic and materialistic, and we know somehow that the voices are wrong, but we're not quite sure how. We have to adjust our lives in one way or another to a whole variety of pressures and challenges. They're the dark headlines. And so, for some, there's been a return to a fundamentalism, to an orthodoxy, to an evangelism, to the cults. But to those of us who cannot set history aside, to those of us who insist that the heart and the mind must work as partners, we can't, in matters religious, simply turn the mind off. To those of us who are in that situation, Reform liberal Judaism has not yet been able to develop and popularize an understanding which would allow us to sense what can be gained by a more active participation in Jewish life, what God, if you will, demands of us. And the problem really is that we're still, most of us, conditioned to thinking in the old-fashioned terms. We're still thinking as if it's all written. We define Judaism as tradition. We give to the Orthodox control of that definition. Again and again, I hear people say, I hear you say, I'm not pious, by which you mean you don't observe the full regimen of kashrut or the 2 days of the holidays. But the people who are most likely to say that to me are here every week. And they have Seder. And they participate actively in Jewish life. They are pious, but in a very different kind of way. We began as a community committed to change. We introduced time, the dimension of time, into the religious equation. We used history in order to validate our right to reshape Judaism. And I would submit to you, we need to continue to keep before us this concept of time. Judaism is not what was written way back then. That's part of the continuum. Judaism is whatever we make Judaism to be. Judaism is the immediacy, the openness, the urgency that with which we approach our tradition, we approach this Jewish world of which we're part, this Jewish civilization which is all around us. It is the degree to which we allow this tradition to speak to us, to command us. We are shaped by it, and in the process, we shape it anew. What I'm saying to you is this, that the validation for faith, for Judaism, for all that makes us Jews, lies in our willingness to be open to be responsive to this tradition of ours. Now, in the last 30 or 40 years, Jews have again become responsive to one major element of the Jewish equation. We've become responsive to the sense of peoplehood, to the sense of community. One would not have believed, looking at American Judaism in the 1910s and 1920s, that we would have that kind of organic, voluntary community, the communal energy, which is manifested in every aspect of Jewish life, in terms of the institutions of our own city, in terms of our concerns for the refuseniks, our concern for the Jews of the Argentine, the long history of our involvement with the Jews of Israel. All of this is remarkable, but it's civic. It's at the level of human relationships and a communal sense. In here, there's still a void for most of us. In here, we're still not sure what we really believe and what it is that Judaism asks of us, demands of us, how Judaism speaks to us. And we're looking for somebody else to give us the answer. And what I'm saying to you is that Judaism, you find your own answer. You find it in the degree to which you are willing to participate, as you are this morning in worship, and the degree to which you are willing to weave the patterns of Jewish life into your home, into the fabric of your family, the degree to which we are willing to confront with those who are intimate with you the elemental questions of our tradition, the degree in which you're willing to participate in the emotional and spiritual sides of our religious tradition. That's Judaism. Is it true? It's true for us. And what is its truth? I've never known what revelation means, really. But I do know this, that wherever the Torah has been read over the last 2,000 years, and you remember it's read in an arbitrary annual cycle, week by week going through the Torah as we go, wherever it's been read, under whatever conditions, whatever were the needs of that congregation, this mood of that moment, someone has been able to find in that text an insight relevant to that occasion. That's revelation. That's a remarkable achievement. There must be something special there. And I do know this, that those who are willing to involve themselves intimately in the spiritual life of the congregation and to weave all those assets which Judaism can provide for the home into the fabric of the home, insofar as they can do it, find themselves feeling more satisfied, more certain of what it is that God really asks of them and what it is that Judaism can provide for. for them. This last week, I gave the confirmation examination to this year's confirmation class. And some of them did very well. Some, of course, didn't do so well. But what interested me is that among those who did very well, there are a number whom I know haven't the faintest idea what Judaism is all about. They know the answers to the questions. They can define Judaism. They can describe a Jewish wedding or a Jewish funeral. But they don't know what it means to participate in, to be part of. In largest part, in most cases, I'm afraid, because they've never seen it within the context of their homes. And I speak of this morning not only because it's a message which I think is important for all of us, but because this very lovely service presented to us by the high school youth group of our temple represents a service conducted for us by young people who have learned to participate in, not simply to discuss, not simply to deal with the ideas of, but to participate in worship in all of the kinds of opportunities which Jewish life, in a religious sense, permits. And I think that they would admit that their lives have been changed to a certain degree in this process. Judaism becomes not simply a label, it becomes something alive. You become part of a community. You feel comfortable within this world. Life isn't quite as uncertain. You're not standing so on such slippery ground as you were standing before. I wish all of our young people could participate in the kinds of activities that the youth group and the high school involve themselves in. But most importantly, I hope and pray that over the years, all of us will get over our intellectualization, our dealing with Judaism as if it's a set of disembodied ideas. Judaism has ideas. But you know, when I look back upon my home, as you look back upon yours, it's not so much what your parents said, but the context of the life they created for you, that shaped you, that conditioned you, that gave you the values which are yours. And that's true of Judaism, the great spiritual tradition which we share. It's not how well I can explain to you the Jewish idea about this or that. But it's what you can bring of Judaism into your own spirit. And Judaism has this to offer to you and to me today. Not only an ennobling spiritual vision, not only a demanding ethic, but structure. You know, the greatest problem we face is that there are so many opportunities, so many ways of spending our time, so many demands on our time, so many ways of getting to the point where we feel frenzied. We feel we're on a treadmill. We don't know where we're going or how we're going to get off. Life doesn't have shape for us any longer. Judaism has a schedule. The Sabbath, the holidays. It has form. It has structure. From time to time, it slows us down. From time to time, it says, hey, stop thinking about whatever it is that's been preoccupying you in a worldly sense. Think about yourself. Think about God. Think about the things which are emotional and spiritual in that sense. Judaism, if we make it part of our lives, brings that sense of structure which keeps us from getting mad in a mad world. And our world is, to a very degree, running away from us, running away with us. And so I give you Judaism because I would share sanity with you. And I give you Judaism because I would share the sacred with you. Amen. Thank you. Eternal God, we face the morrow with hope made stronger by the vision of your kingdom. A world where poverty and war are banished, where injustice and hate are gone. Teach us more and more to share the pain of others, to heed your call for justice, to pursue the blessing of peace. Help us, O God, to gain victory over evil, to bring nearer the day when all the world shall be one. On that day, the age-old hope shall come true. On that day, O God, you shall be one, and your name shall be one. Gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Early or late, all must answer the summons to return to the reservoir of being. We lose our hold on life when our time has come, as a leaf falls from the bough when its day is done. The deeds of the righteous enrich the world as the fallen leaf enriches the soil beneath. The dust returns to the earth. The spirit lives on with God. Like the stars by day, our beloved dead are not seen by mortal eyes, but they shine on forever. Theirs is eternal peace. Let us be thankful for the companionship that continues in love and is stronger than death, sanctifying the name of God, that the mourners rise now and do honor to the memory of their loved ones. Itkadal v'itkadash shemer haba, v'yalma divrach yirute v'yamlich malachute, v'chayechon v'yomechon, V'chaye d'chol Beit Yisrael ba'gala uvizman kari v'imru, amen. Yehe shemer haba mevorach lo'olam ul'olmei olmaya. Yitbarach v'yishtabach v'yitpo'ar v'yitromam v'yitnasei. V'yitadar v'yitale v'yitalal shemei d'kudusha b'richu. Le'la min kol birchata v'shirata, tush b'chata v'nechemata d'amiran b'olma v'imru, amen. Departed whom we now remember, David Smolovitz, Dr. William B. Marcus, and Hilda Ware, who passed away from our midst during this last week. And the souls of Patricia Ann Newman, Ethel R. Levine, Morris H. Hausman, Jack P. Roth, Norma Davidson Levine, Carolyn Stone Copper, Louis A. Bloomfield, Lena DeVay, Dr. Benjamin Levine, Siddy C. Freed, Ida Gimp Sperling, Aaron R. Coleman, Leonard M. Bialoski, Rhea C. Katz, Lottie W. Gray, Aaron Goldman, Henry C. Shapoff, Rosetta Hayes, Belle Klein, Edward Ahrens, Edward Waldman, Eva Dworkin, William J. Bass, Carolyn Klaus, Joseph M. Goldwasser, Ben T. Cohn, Gilbert George Kaplan, Ricky L. Haber, Manuel Weinberger, Sidney S. Roberts, Jenny Berg, Charles R. Finn, Annette Silverman, Mattis Y. Goldman, Louis Horkheimer, and Morris H. Stoller. The anniversaries of whose deaths occurred during this past week. And to the souls of all whom we at this hour remember in tenderest affection, may peace and bliss be granted in the world of eternal life. These still live on earth in the acts of goodness they performed in the hearts of those who cherish their memory. May the beauty of their lives abide ever among us as a loving benediction. Yehe shalom haraba min shumaya v'chayim, aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru, amen. Ose shalom b'imromav, huya ase shalom, aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru, amen. May the Father of peace send peace to all who mourn, and may he comfort all the bereaved among us. And now to complete some of the very lovely moments of this day, Rabbi Susan Berman, who has been the director of our high school and of our youth group this year, has a number of important presentations to make.
Congratulations to all of you, first of all. Becky, as you read from the Torah this morning, Moses ascended Mount Nebo and was told to look about him and see the promised land. And this was, of course, before he died, but this was the promise that God was fulfilling, that the children of Israel would indeed cross over. Almost in that